Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Hospitals, schools and homes, all targets in Syria's conflict uncovered by UN-appointed investigators who on Tuesday condemned likely fresh war crimes by all parties in the country's long-running conflict. In its latest report, the Commission of Inquiry on Syria highlighted likely war crimes by both pro-government forces and UN-designated terrorists, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, HTS, in the northwest of the country. Commission Chair Paolo Pinheiro said that it was completely abhorrent that after more than 9 years, civilians were attacked while going about their daily lives.
All sides likely committed war crimes. Children were shelled at school, parents were shelled at the market, patients were shelled at the hospital. Entire families were bombarded, even while fleeing these attacks. Terrorists and armed groups launched indiscriminate attacks on civilians in government-controlled areas.
Uganda has opened its borders to thousands of people fleeing murderous attacks in Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo, the UN refugee agency UNHCR said on Tuesday. More than 3,000 refugees crossed last week during a temporary opening of two border crossing points in northwestern Uganda, part of a larger group of around 45,000 people who fled attacks in Ituri province in May. The development comes amid intensifying violence attributed to the Allied Democratic Forces, ADF, in the last 18 months, particularly in Ituri, as well as deadly intercommunal violence involving Hema and Lendu people and the Kodeko group. Here's UNHCR spokesperson Charlie Yaxley.
Some of the refugees shared heart-wrenching accounts of militia attacks on their villages to our staff. Many of them told us they were separated from their families and had little time to pack any belongings or look for family members before fleeing. Very few were able to carry personal items, and most fled barefoot with only the clothes they were wearing.
Mr. Yaxley noted that 65% of the new arrivals in Uganda were children, along with 33 pregnant women, two of whom were immediately taken to a health centre last week to give birth. They had been unable to cross for more than a month owing to border closures on the Uganda side to contain the spread of COVID-19. To date, Ugandan authorities have conducted new coronavirus testing, with the first 570 samples returning negative, UNHCR said. The agency welcomed Uganda's decision to allow the group of refugees to enter the country and said that it had demonstrated how quarantines, health screenings and other measures allowed states to uphold their obligations under international law during the pandemic. More than 70 million people are expected to fall in extreme poverty because of COVID-19, the UN Human Rights Council heard on Tuesday, as a leading rights expert slammed greatly exaggerated claims of global poverty eradication between 1990 and 2015. UN-appointed independent special rapporteur Olivier de Schutter insisted that without China's outsized contribution in lifting hundreds of millions of people out of poverty in that time, global progress in reversing the scourge suddenly appeared far less impressive. According to the World Bank's International Poverty Line, IPL, which is $1.90, the number of people in extreme poverty fell from 1.895 billion in 1990 to 736 million in 2015. But this includes the 750 million people in China living below the poverty line in 1990, who numbered just 10 million in 2015, the special rapporteur explained, before questioning the very weak and unsatisfactory World Bank measure of poverty. Leaving out China, the number of people living below $2.50 a day would barely have changed throughout this period, and it would have increased by 140 million people in sub-Saharan Africa and the Middle East, Mr. de Schutter said. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alice Smith.
While oil rushes out of the Gulf and the economy staggers toward the exits, scientists continue to investigate our longer future. For example, could it get so hot that large parts of the heavily inhabited Earth would have to be abandoned? And I asked two popular bloggers why are most of the public blissfully unaware of how heat kills? Do you know the operating temperature of your skin? And no, it's not 98.6 or 37 degrees C. Scientists predict more extreme heat waves as the planet warms. They are already happening, with more records set in North America, Europe, Asia, and Australia every year. Pakistan just set an all-time record high, over 53 degrees or 129 Fahrenheit. Over 1,000 people just died in India from heat stress. Who goes first? If you guessed the elderly, you were only partly right. Babies and teenagers are on that list. And anyway, won't all of us be seniors someday as the heat increases? Never mind, you and I will have air conditioning. Until the power goes out, as it regularly does during heat waves. And despite all the images on TV, heat kills more of us than tornadoes, hurricanes, or lightning combined. We'll thrash through that with John Cook, the Australian host of the Skeptical Science blog, and then with Stuart Staniford, a techie and energy specialist writing in the Early Warning blog. Then, with something completely different, scientist Mark Moffat tells us how ants adapt to climate change. When I hear these bugs have agriculture, including pesticides, I begin to wonder if ants are the next civilization after us. Here we go. What if Earth becomes too hot for humans to function outside? Science fiction or real science? Let's investigate with Australian blogger John Cook. His well-known blog is called Skeptical Science. John studied physics at the University of Queensland, Australia. He's not a climate scientist, but he relies on peer-reviewed papers by others. Like many of us, John was drawn to a startling new paper recently published in PNAS, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. It combines work by an Australian, Dr. Stephen C. Sherwood, from the University of New South Wales, and an American scientist, Matthew Huber, from Purdue Climate Change Research Center. Sherwood and Huber investigated the upper limits of human survival in a warming world. Their paper is called An Adaptability Limit to Climate Change Due to Heat Stress. So, John Cook, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
Why is this scientific paper important to the rest of us?
I guess one of the key results is, and I get this on my website a lot, is people say, well, no matter how hot it gets, you know, we can adapt. We can, you know, we'll get used to it, or we'll, I don't know, turn up the air conditioner or something. But what the paper finds is there is a limit on what we can adapt to, and the human body needs to be warmer than its environment to cool down. So once the temperature gets over a certain point, the body just can't cool down. And at that point, you know, we can go through hypothermia or heat stroke, and, you know, health issues become important.
You know, it's strange that we go through so much education, and yet many of us don't really know how our body works, you know, what temperature our skin needs to be and why perspiration is there. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, I'm not a medical expert either, but I can give you the basics of it. Like our inner body needs to be regulated at, I think it's around 37 or 39 degrees. And so in order for our body to release heat, the skin temperature needs to be at about 35 degrees. So for that to happen, the air temperature needs to be at a cooler than that. But also what's important is the humidity. You'll find if you're in dry air, the body can cool down easier because it's easier for the sweat to evaporate. But if it's humid, it's harder to cool down, which I guess is when you're in really hot, humid environments, just really uncomfortable. Once conditions get to the point where it's either too hot or too humid or both, and the body can't cool down, that's when the body starts to struggle.
Right. And also, there's something in the paper. We need to go and explain the difference between wet bulb temperature and the numbers that we're used to seeing on a thermometer or a weather forecast. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I was talking about humidity and how that changes our ability to evaporate and cool. The definition that scientists use to work out what temperature our body needs to be at is the wet bulb temperature. What that strictly means is if you took a thermometer and you covered it with like a wet cloth and and it was fully ventilated, you know, there was air blowing past it. Whatever temperature the thermometer gave you is a wet bulb temperature. And what the paper found is that the wet bulb temperature can get no hotter than 35 degrees. If we spend more than a couple of hours hotter than that, then you'll get hypothermia.
Right, and that's hyperthermia, listeners. We're used to hearing hypothermia for cold, but hyperthermia is, we call it heat stroke as well sometimes. So the paper says we can't really go over 35 degrees in wet bulb temperature, around 95 Fahrenheit in humid conditions. But right now on Earth, we seldom exceed 31 degrees of wet bulb temperature. So, John, why worry?
Well, what the paper found was that if we experience warming of about, let me see, I think it was up to 7 degrees, like large regions of the Earth would actually become uninhabitable. We expect, you know, about maybe 1 degree over the next 50 years or so, depending on how our carbon emissions change. But as we go further into the future, that's just going to, you know, the temperature range will get a lot further than that, depending on what our carbon trajectory is now. So probably the most startling result I got from this paper was that we talk about rising sea levels a lot and how as sea levels rise, that will make a lot of regions uninhabitable. But what this paper found was the corresponding temperature rise will make even more regions uninhabitable. So I think heat stress is something that probably doesn't get as much attention as other issues to do with global warming. But what we're observing is there are actually more people dying, like currently, from heat stress than other natural disasters like hurricanes and floods. So, yeah, it's something that will get worse over time, but it's also something that's happening now. In fact, over the last few weeks, Pakistan and India are experiencing like record heat waves, the hottest on record, and hundreds of people are dying there because a lot of remote rural villages just don't have access to, I guess, air conditioners or ways to cool themselves down.
Right. I've been reading about that with some alarm. The latest reports I saw were well over 1,000 dead in India alone and Pakistan.
I hadn't been updated. The last couple of days, a few days ago, I saw several hundred. Right. They said that was likely to be an underestimate because a lot of the reports hadn't come in from the remote villages.
And, of course, they don't have as tight a medical system for measuring just why did this person die. But we're also finding that certain portions of the population are more likely to die. Obviously, I think that includes seniors, but also younger children are passing away. And surprisingly, some people with mental illnesses are twice as likely to die from heat stroke.
Okay, I hadn't heard that. I read a statistic this morning. I think it was just in Australia, but it surprised me, actually. It said that about 10% of the heat stroke deaths were children, and about like 40% were elderly, but just over 50% were the 10 to 60-year-olds. So, yeah, although obviously the elderly and the young are especially vulnerable, there was still a greater proportion were, you know, that just middle range of age. I thought it would have been more elderly, but, yeah, that statistic surprised me a little.
It surprises me, too. And I know you mentioned the map provided by Sherwood and Huberb in their study, and they say that the sort of lack of habitability of certain areas starts at 7 degrees centigrade from where we are now. But when you get around 11 or 12, they show you another map, which includes large parts of South America, big hunks of Asia, big parts of China, and Australia being totally uninhabitable for humans. They just couldn't go outside and do any work, which would include agriculture, I presume, too. So, I mean, here we have Australia maybe become uninhabitable in 200 or 300 years, and yet the country's ramping up its coal exports. Does the government or the public realize even this extreme risk?
I don't think so, no. And I think the government is more concerned about the next election cycle than, you know, conditions a century or more into the future. And that's one of the main problems, I think. It's just hard for us to imagine things that have happened so far into the future.
But we have to care about whether our country will go on and our civilization will go on. This is Radio EcoShock. We are talking with John Cook, host of the blog SkepticalScience.com. John, you've accumulated a good community of commenters on your blog as well, and one entry really caught my attention about this heat situation. He said, the difficulty with air conditioning is that most household air conditioners are only rated up to about 41 degrees centigrade, some to 43 degrees, I think. When the temperature rises to 51 C for any length of time, like a summer heat wave, we'll either have to invent better air conditioners and dehumidifiers or find another way to keep cool. And he points out that's only 4 degrees C warmer than it got in the heat wave in Melbourne in southern Australia last year. So there may be limitations to that fallback strategy of air conditioning, not to mention the increased loads often lead to power failures anyway. Can you tell us something about the heat events that you have experienced in Australia in the last year or two?
Well, Australia is, we seem to be copying a lot of the global warming impacts, maybe are less than you might be experiencing over there. But in Brisbane a few years ago, we had a heat wave where about just over 20 people died. In Melbourne or in Victoria, in the southeast of Australia, it's been hot and dry. And the result of that is that it's the bushfire conditions are like they've had to invent a new scale because the danger has gotten so high. And you know, we've experienced some very severe bushfires because of that, and whole towns getting gutted over the last few years. So, yeah, there's just been a gradual, I guess, evolution of more heat waves and more dire conditions.
Well, that seems to be the way it goes. I was looking at a paper or figures from the American National Center for Atmospheric Research, and they say over the past decade, daily high record temperatures in the United States outnumbered record lows by 2 to 1. So there are twice as many record highs in the last 10 years than there were lows. So record heat is becoming almost the norm. We hear it so often on the weather forecasts. Is that true in Australia too? They keep talking about new records being set?
I actually read that paper about the U.S. record highs. And at the time, I also read that a similar study is being done about analysing Australian temperature record, but I don't think it's come out yet. I imagine it probably is just based on the anecdotal evidence of what we're experiencing. But, yeah, I'm looking forward to when that paper can come out. We can see what the results say.
Well, we'll look for it. And when scientists speculate fossil fuels could drive us to the upper limits of human tolerance for heat, people who I would call deniers routinely fire back ideas like this one. They say, well, scientists can't predict the weather next week, so why should we believe anything 100 years from now? How do you answer that?
I guess comparing weather to climate is like comparing apples and oranges in one sense. And the way I understand it is think of throwing a dice. It's completely random whether you get a 1 or a 6, and you can't possibly predict the single roll of a dice. But if you roll the dice like 6,000 times, for instance, you can predict with reasonable accuracy that you're going to get 1,000 sixes and 1,000 ones. Now, with climate is essentially weather averaged over time. And while weather is random and chaotic, like the throwing of a dice, over time we can predict how it's going to behave, how the climate's going to behave. And what global warming is doing is it's like weighting the dice. Just so you weigh the dice so that you get 6 more often. What we're doing is weighting our climate so that we get record hot days more often. And as time's going on, that's what we're seeing. As that study from the US showed, we're seeing twice as many record hot days as record cold days. And that trend is actually increasing. 30 years ago, it was almost equal, the amount of hot days versus the amount of record cold days. But now it's gradually moved up to double, and it's still going upwards. Yeah, so once you average the weather out over time, we see long-term trends, and the trend at the moment is more record hot days.
I really appreciate the way you put that. I want to move to something else here. John, as I talk with climate scientists, and often after the call is finished, they'll talk to me a little more frankly even, and as I've done some research on the heat deaths, I suspect we may not reach this limit 300 years from now, but much sooner. We already face ongoing series of heat challenges like the hundreds dead in Chicago in 1995 and at least 35,000 killed by heat in Europe in 2003. And as you've said, many more have died in a killer heat wave in Pakistan and India. So I think deadly heat is already underestimated when we talk about global warming. Would you disagree with that?
That's a tough one, I guess. I was looking up some statistics on heat-related deaths, and it is tricky because while the heat waves are getting more often, I guess technology has also developed, so our ability to adapt to it has improved to some degree. So, yeah, I probably couldn't answer that definitively, like whether... The other thing is, when they record a person's death, they can put different causes of death. So, yeah, I'm not 100% certain on how accurately they record the exact number of heat-related deaths.
Right.
When we get into medical areas, it does get a little more complicated, I guess.
It is difficult. I know, for example, looking at the official reports from the French government about the deaths there, they said, well, it's possible up to half of these deaths were really caused by the high ozone levels, in other words, really the smog that came out at the same time, but then the smog was worse because of the heat. So we've kind of classified that as a heat-related death. It wasn't a heat death, but heat-related. And also people sometimes come in from smog, they have heart attacks, and that's the cause of death, even though it might not have happened had they been in an air-conditioned room or someone was looking after them. So it's tough, I agree. Well, look, it isn't as though we aren't being warned by scientists or even governments. John, let me read you just a couple of paragraphs from a U.S. government website. It says, for example, by the end of this century, the number of heat wave days in Los Angeles is projected to double and the number in Chicago to quadruple if emissions are not reduced. Projections for Chicago suggest the average number of deaths due to heat waves would more than double by 2050 under a lower emission scenario and quadruple under a higher emission scenario. And they go on to talk about California and again, a lot of increase in their heat-related deaths. And even those numbers presume that people will buy more air conditioners and will figure out how to open windows in these closed office buildings and will adapt somewhat. They still expect the heat deaths to go up. I have heard Dr. Martin Cope of CSIRO saying that there's about 1,000 heat deaths in Australia and the heat and the smog increases that by about 20%. So it's coming, mate, but why is the public still so unaware of this growing danger? I just can't get past that.
I actually read a page on the CSIRO website earlier today about that, and they were saying that dangers to humanity, heat wave is almost considered like an ambient background danger compared to like more, I guess, vivid impacts like hurricanes and tornadoes and a twister that we had in Sydney for the first time ever last week, which got a lot of press. I guess heat waves are, maybe they're not as sexy and don't get the same amount of attention. But what the CSIRO also mentioned was that the number of deaths from heat waves was equal or greater than the number of deaths from hurricanes and floods and tornadoes all combined. So I think it is something that I only really started to become aware of it when I read the Sherwood paper and when I realised that heat stress is actually making more regions or will make more regions uninhabitable than sea level rise. That was a bit of an eye-opener for me. I always thought of sea level rise in my head as one of the primary impacts on humanity, but obviously there is a lot of different impacts from global warming, and as time goes on, we're understanding them more, and I'm becoming a bit more concerned as I learn more.
Well, me too. I was surprised. I mean, we call it global warming, and it's kind of a, well, duh. I mean, of course people may die of excess heat, but I hadn't really done the research and looked into it, and now I think this will come up as a greater public image, even though we don't find any stimulating footage of the old and the young quietly passing away from heat exposure. we can't show the wrecked cars and houses, but there are definitely holes in some families where some loved ones Well, John, we haven't even discussed the impact of heat waves on agriculture. Last year's combination of heat and drought smashed Australia's farm production, from what I've read. Lester Brown warns that rice is already at the limits of heat tolerance, just a couple of degrees more when the plants are setting fruit and the rice crops could fail, threatening millions with starvation. And then you have farm animals who are mammals just like us. They're going to have the same heat problems, and they won't likely be air-conditioned, or some won't even be able to go inside. So I wonder, is it possible that these heat waves, in addition to leading to more mortality, could lead to starvation the way cold and frosts have done in the past?
I imagine so. I know that Sherwood touches on that fairly briefly in talking about how particular cattle will also be affected by it. I don't know of any studies in actual numbers on the impacts, but yeah, it's when I guess climate skeptics say there's a lot of uncertainty. A lot of this uncertainty can go in the other direction. There's things that we haven't even really investigated on how it'll affect us. And I guess heat waves on agriculture is one of those things where we haven't even begun to understand just how bad it could get.
Well, that's a great opening for me to ask you to describe some of your other work you do with your blog. Tell us about The Skeptical Scientist and the issues you cover.
Well, basically, what I'm trying to do is, I guess, just explain how climate skepticism misleads people. Because what I found is, as I've built up a database of skeptic arguments and then looked at what the science says about each argument, I found that what each argument does, all of them have in common this one trait, that they look at a small piece of the puzzle while neglecting the bigger picture. And the more I thought about it, the more I investigated, the more I realized it's almost inevitable that they had to do it this way, because when you look at all the evidence for global warming and that humans are causing it, there are like multiple lines of evidence showing it. And in terms of the evidence that global warming is happening, there are like tens of thousands of lines of evidence, with ice sheets melting and glaciers retreating and thousands of species all over the world are migrating and just showing all these signs in every part of the globe. So we don't just have a consensus of scientists, we have a consensus of evidence. And so the only way really to deny this is to just focus on little bits of the data while ignoring the full picture. So what I'm trying to do is look at each skeptic argument and then present the bigger picture and show how each argument is focusing on just a small piece of the puzzle by putting it into context.
And I notice you've just started appearing on the new climate podcast, Irregular Climate, with Dan Mutal. What are you doing there?
Yeah, well, Dan started a podcast just a few weeks ago and was just, I guess, asking if anyone wanted to contribute among the, I guess, climate blogging community. And I thought I might just have a try at just giving one, I guess, skeptic argument debunk each week. It's the first time I've ever done any recording like that, so it was, I just done my first one and I have to record a second one today. I'm still deciding which argument I'm going to tackle. So that's an interesting experience, but I think podcasting is good. Like, it's just another way of communicating science, and as you say, there's a lack of awareness among the public. So I probably should put heat stress as one of the high priorities that I should cover, I guess.
Right. From Australia, we've been talking extreme heat with John Cook, host of the Skeptical Science blog at skepticalscience.com. John, thank you so much for your continuing work and the insight you've given us today.
My pleasure.
I'm Alex for Radio EcoShock. I like people who can dig into problems and find insights the rest of us miss. That's why I've called up Stuart Staniford. He has a doctorate in physics and a master's in computer science. By day, Stuart is chief scientist for the computer security company FireEye. By night, he's a well-known energy commentator, especially at theoildrum.com and on his own blog, Early Warning. Stuart, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Sure, you're welcome. Thanks, Alex.
Well, look, your blog is called Early Warning, Risks to Global Civilization. An article you posted on May 6th certainly caught my attention and bounced all over the net. Really, it was the inspiration for this program. The title is Odds of Cooking the Grandkids. What inspired you to write that?
Well, it came out of a paper that was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences by two scientists, Stephen Sherwood at the University of New South Wales and Matthew Huber at Purdue University here in the U.S. And they were basically looking at, there is this possibility that what's called the climate sensitivity, how much the temperature is going to increase as a result of our increasing carbon dioxide, there's a small possibility that it will be really high and that temperatures will go really high. And so they were looking at which portions of the planet would become uninhabitable in that scenario, in the sense that, if you go outside in the summer, then, you just wouldn't be able to physiologically make it for any length of time.
And you wouldn't be able to do meaningful work, and we'll get to that. Well, look, we've talked about the idea of wet bulb temperature with our other guest, John Cook, but that is the key, isn't it? High temperatures and high humidity.
No, that's right. I mean, the higher the humidity, the less good sweating does you. So there comes a point where if the humidity is high enough and the temperature is high enough, then your body just can't cool itself when your core temperature gets higher and higher, and then eventually you go into heat shock.
In another article, you look at the demographics of heat deaths. Who is most likely to die?
Obviously, the elderly are more likely, or very young children if they're exposed to outside temperatures. And then people doing manual labor outside obviously face significantly higher risk.
I find that when we say that old people will die, people tend to shrug that off if they're not old, but not realizing that we're all going to be old people and our lives will matter to us. And, here in Canada, the number of people over 65 is expected to double by 2036. And sometime just 5 years from now, there will be more seniors in Canada than children age 14 and under. So we could have a lot of deaths, and even those who do survive hyperthermia, as heat strokes are called medically, the survivors often have brain damage and they require serious care. If heat waves do become more common, as some scientists predict, wouldn't this be a huge drain on families and on the economy? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, eventually, yeah. I mean, obviously it's one of those things that's going to creep up on us over the course of the century, right? I mean, it's not going to be like suddenly, this massive heat wave is much worse than we used to. It's going to be more like with each passing decade, there's a little more likely to be really serious heat waves. And then depending on just how sensitive the climate is to our carbon emissions, could get really, really bad by the end of the century. Or if we're lucky and it's not as sensitive as it might be, then it'll be less serious. But obviously there are some parts of the planet where heat shock's already a problem, and they're almost certainly going to get somewhat worse.
Well, that was something I wanted to get to in another entry in your early warning blog. You wondered if there are parts of the world already approaching these human heat limits, and you cite the possible example in India, and that was published before the recent heat waves, with thousands of deaths that just happened in India, not to mention the new record high in Pakistan, 53.7 Celsius, or 129 degrees Fahrenheit at the end of May. Can you tell us what you found out about those quarry workers in India?
Yeah, well, so I had looked at these maps that Shepard and Huber had put in their paper of, where the planet was going to become uninhabitable. And kind of the area that was already worst was a band across part of the Amazon and then a band across northern India and Pakistan. And so I was sort of scouting around looking for scientific information on that area, and I came across this study by an Institute of Occupational Health in India that was looking at the situation of various kinds of manual workers in Gujarat and Rajasthan states in northern India. And basically the conclusion of that study was these guys, particularly in this quarry in Rajasthan that was one of the study sites, were pretty much already at the limit of, there were already a number of them that were suffering quite serious symptoms like confusion and complete collapse every so often as a result of working in this quarry. So it was pretty clear that working outside in the summer in those parts of India during a heat wave is already very marginal as something that humans can do. And obviously the recent news that you just mentioned has only made it clearer. So, you know, it's clear that those areas are going to be in trouble, you know, are already in some degree of trouble, and that's going to get worse pretty quickly.
A best of Radio EcoShock replay.
Well, we have a form of denial, I say, here in the West that we'll all be fine due to air conditioning. But that depends upon increasing our energy supply, and if we apply it to other parts of the world, we'd have to expand world energy production just as we hit what some people think is peak oil. Your work's pretty well known on that. Do you think that air conditioning is really realistic when we start talking about India and China and Africa and South America?
It's hard to say. I mean, the problem is that oil itself is not, by and large, in the developed world anyway, used for generating electricity, which is what obviously powers air conditioners. So in principle, there's no connection to peak oil. However, it places a strain on overall energy demand. And obviously, to the extent that we're meeting most of our electricity production demand from coal, there's this sort of nasty feedback loop where as the planet warms up, we need more electricity and more coal to power air conditioning, and that in turn is further increases the climate change, right? So I think that's a significant problem. And at the moment, you know, India and China and those countries are getting wealthier, and just that alone will tend to increase their demand for electricity and for air conditioning in particular. So I think, I mean, there's definitely a serious question as we get out towards the end of the 21st century, whether we're just going to end up in this sort of spiraling situation of ever hotter temperatures and ever more energy demand creating ever hotter temperatures. It seems like that would be really ugly. To the extent we're able to transition to predominantly renewable and or nuclear, you know, basis for our society, then it could be in much better shape.
Still, it's not a very pleasing picture to think that we'll have to huddle inside air-conditioned rooms possibly for a week at a time, afraid to go out.
Yeah, absolutely. And depending on where you are, I mean, you guys up in Canada, I mean, the research shows that people's happiness is strongly affected by the extremes of temperature, right? So in extremely cold climates, it tends to be the coldest portions of the year that have the most influence on people's mental state. Of when you ask them how is life going overall, you know, if they live in a place that's either very, very cold in the winter or very, very hot in the summer, that tends to have a negative effect on how happy they say they are. So, you know, up in Canada, there'll be some benefit in mitigating the winter extremes. But in places like, you know, for example, the eastern half of the U.S. that are already hot and humid in the summer, I think it's going to get just uglier and uglier over time.
In many parts of North America, our buildings are depend entirely on cheap fossil fuels for cooling. In the commercial buildings, those floor-to-ceiling glass walls don't even have windows that open, and there are huge AC costs already. And the same is true of those highly energy inefficient monster houses that were all the rage. I wonder if we have built ourselves into an unsustainably hot corner.
Well, definitely the building stock is, you're right, it's the building stock is adapted to low to cheap energy, and building stock only turns over very slowly, and it's going to take a long time to fix it. And we're not even trying all that seriously at the moment, so yeah, it's a big problem.
And let's look at another technical challenge. Our power grids tend to break down when the AC demand is highest. Let me give you just a couple of quick examples for the listeners. The famous Northeast blackout of 2003 occurred on a hot August day. It was over 88 degrees or 31 Celsius. People turning on their air conditioning was deemed a minor factor in blowing out that whole region over many states and in Ontario, Canada. And again, in 2006, British authorities blamed the Greater London blackout on increased air conditioning during that heat wave, and ditto the 2007 power failure in Serbia and Greece, and so on into 2009 and the Australian state of Victoria during a three-day heat wave. So most of us are counting on artificial life support by machines, but that may not be there. What are your thoughts on that, Stuart?
Well, I certainly wouldn't hold myself out as an expert on grid reliability, but it does seem that certainly the peak in electricity demand in the hotter places comes on the hottest days of the year when air conditioning is maximal. And I suppose those peaks are just going to get higher over time.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking through some of the challenges of a warming world with scientist and investigator Stuart Staniford. Stuart, on a larger scale, our cities seem poorly designed. They have become heat islands rather than cooling us down. We cut out the green. We replace it with asphalt. Everybody knows that. The UK government's Met Office predicts heat-related deaths will quadruple by 2080. And they found that cities can be up to 18 degrees Fahrenheit or 10 degrees Celsius hotter at night than the surrounding countryside. So that makes me wonder, and I realize this is just, guesswork, whether some megacities could become unsustainable in the future if climate change does occur.
Yeah, well, they're probably unsustainable now in some sense. But yeah, I'm sure you're right that the amount of energy they demand to cool them will go up and up if we don't take measures to counter that.
What draws your interest into this subject, Stuart?
I don't know, just as a matter of personality, I've always been interested in things that can go wrong, and the bigger they could go wrong, the more my interest is drawn to it. But I'm also, having a scientific training, very data-driven and very much desiring to kind of understand what are the numbers actually tell you about something. And so I kind of like to do detailed quantitative investigations of stuff. In this particular case of this Shepherd and Huber paper, it was scientific work done by others, and I was essentially just kind of making it more accessible to a popular audience.
Can you tell us some of the things that you're working through now?
At the moment, I've just figured out how to make maps in Google Earth from county-level census data. So I'm having a blast going through looking at a whole bunch of demographic variables across mainly the U.S. Because one of my big theses is that climate change and peak oil and the kind of the trends that we have of globalization and automation making for less educated folks having more and more trouble getting a job and making a decent living, these things are all going to affect us together in parallel. And so I'm kind of trying to understand at a county-by-county, neighborhood-by-neighborhood level, what kinds of areas will be most stressed by all these challenges as they all happen together. And, what kind of areas are likely to be more resilient. So the most obvious thing is if you live in a high-income area, you're probably going to be more insulated because you have the money to pay your air conditioning bill or buy oil, even and then there's less of it. Whereas people that live in kind of low-income areas and who nonetheless need to travel a lot for work or who have high needs for cooling, will suffer a lot more. So I'm sort of trying to understand the geography of where do these stresses fall the highest.
So the challenges that people are working on separately may be ends of the same single piece, and you may be able to pull it out of the local level data. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, these things all interact, I think. They're not like isolated individual challenges. People have to meet them all at the same time.
I've just talked with another inquiring mind, Jack Alpert, and his parting words to me were, humans routinely underestimate the challenges we face and always overestimate our ability to muddle through them. Do you think we're going to be able to muddle through such things as heat stress happening at the same time that we have economic difficulties and the energy puzzle goes on?
It depends what you mean by muddle through. I mean, I think will there be still something recognizable as civilization at the end of the 21st century? I think very likely there will. But will a lot of individuals suffer, and particular societies suffer significant harm as a result of these things? I think yes, they will also.
Well, there you go. When inquiring minds want to know, they can turn to the Early Warning blog at earlywarnblogspot.com or look for Stuart Stanford's work at theoildrum.com, energybulletin.net, and other spots around the net. And Stuart, I'd really like to thank you for helping us out today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure, Alex.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
As the planet changes, one species may have the social skills to survive. Of course, I'm talking about ants. Mark Moffat is one of the most colorful bug specialists on the planet. His adventures are legion, and yes, Moffat has appeared on the Colbert Report, as well as some obscure publication called the National Geographic. Mark got his Harvard PhD from the dean of ants, really, famed conservationist Edward O. Wilson. He's currently a research associate in entomology at the Smithsonian Institution. Mark, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hey, glad to be here, Alex.
Can you tell us, just to start off, just a couple of your strange adventures as you tracked bugs around the world?
Well, yeah, I like to tell stories that people don't expect, because we hear too much about lions, tigers, and bears, oh my. And the really cool things, the real aliens among us, are sometimes the insects, and they have some of the greatest stories around. So some of my favorites, which I tracked down for the book Adventures Among Ants that's come out, is are the army ants, like the driver ants of Africa, which can have swarms up to 20 million. Moving, the widest one I've seen is about 100 feet wide, dense with ants, each with little knife blade mandibles capable of cutting human flesh. And so one travels with care in the equatorial Africa region because of those ants. So that's one story. Another one is right here in North America, and that's the story of the slavery ants. And those enslaved ants occur in the ant world only in North America and Europe, and not in the tropics, strangely enough. And I spent some time out there in California, where there's a lot of enslaved ants, and found out why they do it and how they're doing it, and tracked them down in the field, basically.
And is it fair to say that ants have civilizations?
Oh, I think it is fair to say, Alex. The thing is that ants basically form societies in many species that are comparable to ours in numbers, up into the millions. And so that means that they have to deal with the same kind of issues of moving around their resources, of supply and demand, market economies, highways, and infrastructure that we have. Many of the things we do, they have to do just because they, unlike any other animal, have these huge societies.
I was somewhat amazed to read about ant agriculture. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, that's one of the most fascinating instances of a parallel, because ants have indeed broken through and created agriculture about 50 million years before we did. They started certain kinds in the Americas, started raising a fungus for food, their version of the morel mushroom, and they are addicted to it. So after many millennia, they eventually they conquered their fungus so thoroughly they domesticated it, so it cannot return to the wild, just as we domesticated our apples and pears and whatnot. And just like our apples, this fungus has little edible tips, fat little things that the ants eat, full of nutrients and goodness. And the ants cannot survive without their fungus, and the fungus can't survive without them. And the agriculture is so thorough in its parallels to humans that the ants have to weed their fungus. They have to keep it extremely tidy. They even apply pesticides to it. Call them anything you think of that we have to do with agriculture, they have to do, and they've done it long before we did.
I think that is just astounding, and we have a lot to learn from them. You know, one of the problems arising from world trade and travel is invasive species. Are ants being redistributed around the world?
Ants are being redistributed around the world at a very high rate. Now, this is, mind you, just a few species. Most ants are actually ecologically extremely valuable. They move more soil than earthworms at a global level. They add nutrients to the soil. They pollinate. They disperse seeds. They do all kinds of things. If we dropped the ants out of our ecologies, it would be much more devastating to the world than humans disappearing. But the ants also have their bad apples, and those include a few species that have become, they're almost human-like in their skills at traveling around the world and conquering everything they meet. And they have gathered those skills in certain parts of the world, particularly, for example, one place I talk about in the book is northern Argentina, where some of the world's worst invasive species come from the same river valley. And the ants there become so skilled at fighting each other that if they get out of there, they basically wipe out anything they touch. And colonies of those ants have invaded the American South in California, the fire ant in the South, and in California it's the Argentine ant. And these are huge colonies with a massive capacity for warfare.
And there is an ant war currently raging in Southern California, you say?
Yes, well, the largest battlefield ever recorded. You know, ants and humans are the only creatures that really have full-bore warfare. And that, again, is because of the scale of their societies. The largest ant societies have a huge excess labor force, as humans have had in some of their big societies. And unfortunately, both our species have often enough channeled that labor into fighting the neighbors. And these ants in California have the largest societies ever recorded. The largest colony contains about a trillion individuals, extends from San Francisco all the way down to the Mexican border. Along its borders down in the southern part, it comes into contact with three other huge colonies. And along battlefields that go for miles, there are millions of deaths every month, right under people's lawns, out of view. You peel back the grass blades and you just see piles of bodies.
Oh, well, that doesn't sound any better than we are, really. So this is Radio EcoShock. We're talking with Mark Moffat, author of the new book, Adventures Among Ants, A Global Safari with a Cast of Trillions. Mark, all the species of the world will need to adapt to climate change and other impacts of human civilization. Let's look at how ants are doing. First of all, how long have ants been on the Earth?
Oh, about 150 million years. They arose about the time of the dinosaurs, but they kind of, like the mammals, stayed the underdog for a long time until about the time that the dinosaurs collapsed and the angiosperms, the flowering plants, exploded, and that's when ants really started to reign supreme, just like the mammals did at that time. And so they've been around a long time and pretty essential for much of it.
So they've survived many climate changes. I mean, the time of the dinosaurs was very hot. There was no ice at the poles, we think. Have scientists seen changes in the ants this time around?
Well, ant distributions are hard to know. Many of the very rare ones that are most likely to go extinct are not studied in the way rare birds are, but clearly some of them are expanding northwards. Some of them are reaching into Canada now. Americans are just swarming into Canada in the form of ants. And Europeans, the species are basically, in the case of ants, able to move around the world and often driving up mountains. As temperatures warm, of course, species tend to move up mountains and move up latitudes and drive out the species that were at those higher latitudes and elevations. And so it's really the species of northernmost Canada and the higher mountains, like the Rocky Mountains, that are most likely to go extinct, and those would include ants.
And I've read that some ants have air conditioning systems for their colonies.
Yes, well, this is something that maybe we can hope they develop further to survive global warming. I don't know if ants are capable of thinking that fast or moving that fast, but some of them, in fact, do control their colony temperature and oxygen with precision. Huge leafcutter ant colonies, the ones with this agriculture, with this fungus that I was mentioning, they actually have colonies that go 30 feet deep, and they build their tunnels in such a way that the heat moves through them and out volcanic-like entrances that can extend several feet in the air to keep their agricultural fungi nice and oxygenated and cool, and all their babies nice and just at the right temperature, believe it or not.
Well, this may be an offbeat question, but I know that ants have no lungs, so I'm wondering if they could be affected by changes in carbon dioxide levels in the air.
Yeah, well, it's one thing seems to be that higher temperatures end up yielding smaller workers because there's a higher cost of the development of the ants, and this may be one of the reasons why these invasive species do rather well. They're often very small things, like these Argentine ants and fire ants that I mentioned are relatively small ants that boom in numbers and breed very fast, potentially helped out by global warming.
Well, you talk about the multiplication of these species and getting even past ants and into other insects. I understand that some insects will multiply much more rapidly with each degree of temperature rise. What do you know about that?
Well, insects have short generation times and high reproductive rates, so they're more likely to respond quickly to climate change than us long-lived vertebrates, and this is a serious issue for their connections with environmental change. For example, there was a recent study of the green stink bug, which is a species that is an agricultural pest of legumes and rice and so forth around the world. And the scientists actually raised some at a slightly higher temperature, 2.5 degrees higher. And after a little over a year, the ones that were raised at the higher temperature became active earlier in the year. They grew more rapidly. They laid more eggs. And they also had more abnormalities because of perhaps the midsummer heat. So insects are probably changing at a very high rate around the world in response to all kinds of condition changes. Of course, global warming is complicated. Sometimes it's not warming. Sometimes it's the amount of water that's the problem.
Yes, absolutely. You get the extreme precipitation events can wipe out colonies of things. So have we been seeing that?
Well, we certainly have been seeing some extinctions, but right now mostly what we're seeing are species moving if they can. Species tend to go, as I said, to higher latitudes where it's cooler and drive other species farther north. And so species are becoming extinct at the southern end of their ranges and moving up north, or in a similar way moving up mountains. Some species may be able to adjust their behavior. They often come out earlier than in the year, of course, as spring arrives earlier. But the problem is many of the species that are critical to the ecology are things like pollinators, and they're going out of sync with their plants. Of course, the flowers have to be blooming when the pollinators are there to fertilize them, and if that doesn't occur, you can have catastrophes. And that seems to be happening around the world with different, for example, butterflies, which are being studied best.
I realize that we don't even really know all the types of insects that are out there yet, but when we think about climate change, what kind of science do you think needs to be done more, and is it starting to happen?
Well, what we have is the potential for a huge database on climate change, and that's available in the museums across North America, where there are millions and millions of specimens collected in the last century. And if we could gather up the data on when they were collected in each generation and see what's happening, we would have a very clear idea of environmental change across this continent. That kind of work would take a lot of funding, but it's certainly something that's going to gradually emerge, particularly with groups like butterflies, which have been well collected for such a long time.
Yes, I wonder whether humans will care enough to realize how fundamental the ants and the other creatures we've been talking about are to our own survival. Are we just going to get all taken up with the economy and the Gulf oil spill? And these things are very important, but we have a substrata here of insects that are very important to our survival. Are we going to generate enough interest? I think that's something that you do. You generate the interest that perhaps will empower the science that needs to be done to get going.
Yes. Well, of course, even ants need their spokesman occasionally, and they are running the ecology around us unseen and without being paid to do it. And they're doing an amazing amount of work to keep our streets clean and our orchards disease-free. And these are the native species. At the same time, we're having to deal with invasive species, which most annoy us, like the ones that invade our homes. And we tend to, therefore, forget about the good that even an insect like an ant can do. And that's true of the great majority of ant species and insect species.
So we shouldn't be thinking, there's an ant, let's kill it. We should be thinking, there's an ant, we may need that bug.
Yes, I try to avoid stepping on ants whenever possible. This forces me to walk a lot slower in cities like New York than most people walk, unfortunately. But there are ants here and there. The lucky thing about ants is that it's the survival of the queen that matters, as you probably know, Alex. So if you step on an occasional ant, do not feel guilty. She was willing to die for the cause of her colony. The colony survives through the queen and through all those workers that patrol the environment and hopefully, as I say, do positive ecosystem services around North America.
I read in your blog a discussion about super colonies and superorganisms. Can you briefly give us just a slight clue what that discussion is about?
Well, there are two different things. A superorganism is a view that something like an ant colony can be seen as if it was a single organism, like a human body. And that's been an idea treated in a number of different ways, but basically it means that the ants have a very tight identity and affinity for each other, a nationality, if you will, that is so set in stone, they can never, an ant worker can never defect. She is committed, and I say she because the ant workers are female like honeybees. She is committed absolutely to her society, and because of that, the group functions very much as a unit in a way that a human society cannot. And those units can grow vast into these super colonies. That's the other word, a super colony, like the invasive species I talked about in California, where the borders can keep expanding until you have millions upon millions upon millions of workers, all with the same identity. Amazingly enough, you can take an ant worker from San Francisco and that huge colony I mentioned earlier and drive it all the way down to Mexico and drop it off, and it will merge seamlessly with the other ants there. They're all one giant unified tribe. You carry that same ant a quarter inch over the border in San Diego to the next colony, and it's dead within seconds.
We sort of need James Cameron to bring out a 3D version of life in the ants with, you know, a sympathetic view of what's going on there.
Well, this is the amazing thing, because ants, I did my first story for National Geographic under a lady named Mary Smith, and she got Jacques Cousteau and Jane Goodall and Louis Leakey and many famous scientists started there. And I took my first pictures of ants and showed them to her, and she said, you know, this reminds me of the movie Aliens. These are just so cool. You forget how small they are if you photograph them the right way, and the stories are extraordinary. You know, and I wish someone like James Cameron would talk to us ant guys, because real ants in real life is much more exciting than most science fiction that's been created. The stories out there are extraordinary. We're still finding new ones. People interested, young boys and girls interested in becoming naturalists and working in nature, don't have to be stuck in a laboratory. There are great things out there to be discovered.
As we wrap up, is there something else you would like to leave with our listeners?
Well, the Adventures Among Ants is basically, to pursue that thought, my way of showing that adventures don't need to require a chimpanzee or an elephant. You can have adventures anywhere in the world, even in your backyard. You can find these extraordinary stories, and I believe life is about storytelling, and convey them to each other. And I do hope more young people that love nature pursue it with that sense of exploration that started with Charles Darwin way back in the early explorers, and it continues today. So I look forward to meeting some of you young listeners out there in the future and hearing your new stories about ants.
We have been talking ants with Dr. Mark Moffat, the wild man of entomology. His new book from the University of California Press is Adventures Among Ants, A Global Safari with a Cast of Trillions. It is anything but boring, people, and it makes us reconsider our own civilization. Find out more at adventuresamongants.com. Thank you, Mark, for the big picture on these small creatures.
Appreciate it, Alex.
Okay, I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Of course, there are sensible things we can do to stay alive in the coming heat waves and stop cooking our grandkids, like getting off fossil fuels very quickly, changing over our cities from heat sinks to natural cooling centers, and using community planning to care for those most at risk. We'll have to save that for a future Radio EcoShock program. Because we're out of time for this week, friends, don't forget the links to follow up this week's show in my June 10th blog entry at ecoshock.info. Download a copy of this show and all our past programs as free MP3 files from the main website ecoshock.org. I'm Alex. Thank you for warming up to this week's program.